Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and on this episode of Double Feature, here to explain the theme, something about Forrest Gump, Michael Kester.
That's right. So on today's episode of Time Crimes and Hot Tub Time Machine.
Stop. Did you? I'm going to think I accidentally posted the same episode twice. Did you just not get enough Forrest Gump, or what is that? That is the theme today, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. It's a Forrest Gump episode of Double Feature.
Okay, great. So does that mean we need to figure out the arcs and if the Forrest Gump character has learned anything by the end? Or do we totally just throw that by the wayside?
I would love to ignore that. I just don't have zero. I have zero interest in that. So if you've tuned in to today's episode of The Jerk and the Master expecting the aforementioned question to be answered, you can just go right to hell and we'll see you next week.
Principal issues of how the character is affected by the people in his life. Not considered here. Michael refuses. What do you want to talk about instead with these movies today?
It's going to be a little meta. I think meta-er than you might be expecting. I want to talk about cultism. I want to talk about being brought into a world that is bigger than you expected and how easy it is to be led when you're stupid. Well, but it's also going to be a little meta. And like, I know I said that already, but y'all need to be prepared for some meta, because if you're not prepared, you're going to be real disappointed.
Michael's going to break the fourth wall. I feel it coming.
What is breaking the fourth wall in the context of a podcast?
I think it's...
I'm already talking to people.
I'm not really sure, but if it's possible, it's been done in the last 11 years of the show.
I feel like breaking the fourth wall of a podcast is having a fake running gag where you're in a bunker in order to fix up a recording snafu.
Did we ever talk about why that happens? Probably.
No, AC material.
Okay. All right. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, amazing thing no one knows about. All right. That's where I was going, is this AC and the Patreon of the show. We have a Patreon that keeps the show running. I would actually say, if I had to give a real answer to that question no one's asking, breaking the fourth wall probably has something to do with HelloFresh ads, or I don't know, that thing where they send you custom mixed hair dye or whatever the fuck those true crime podcasts are always hawking. Mattresses. Who makes the crappy mattress? Doesn't matter.
Casper? Is it Casper?
Damn it.
Yeah.
Well, so that we don't have to hawk Casper mattresses, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/doublefeature. You go on it, you give a couple dollars to the show, and that allows us to continue being the last fucking podcast on the internet without ads. We're the last one. I checked all of them, listened to every one, and they all have fucking ads and we don't. So that makes ours better somehow.
That sounds boring, and being bored makes me tired, and nothing's a better thing to sleep on than my pillow.
No, stop.
Go to mypillow.com.
No, get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here with your pillow ad. I'm looking at this Patreon and people are putting money into it, and they said no pillow ads on the show. Fake or not, I see the message right here. It's signed all the Patreons. Get your fucking pillow ad off this fucking show. So patreon.com/doublefeature. A big thank you to you guys. I know we try to stream through this part in the beginning of the show, but I do want to say thanks to not just the executive producers, but everybody who's been helping us out over there. We fund the show 100% off of the Patreons, and also the money I save from sneaking into my friends' movies. So that I sneak back out of, as I got called out on the show a couple of weeks ago. I really shouldn't have said that on the air, but I did. So thanks to the Patreons for providing me that opportunity, is where I was going with that. We're going to spoil these films, and we're going to spoil one of them first.
Cool. I think we should spoil The Jerk first, just based on chronology. Although The Master, if you're speaking from a chronological standpoint, is spoiled before The Jerk by having happened before The Jerk was made.
when a comedy starts with I was born a poor black child and then a flashback kicks in, does it create an inner sense of alarm in you that it doesn't?
Oh my God, dude. Yeah. I just went, okay, it's, I'm trying to think, there's something recently that this same thing happened to me with where I was watching the movie. I'm just like, okay, so how much of this am I just going to have to go? It was the
70s. Yeah.
And
was it every politician from Virginia? Was
Jesus
that?
Christ. No, it was when I went and saw Bride of Chucky. I saw there's a restoration screening of Bride of Chucky, and the guy who was announcing it was just like, there is sort of a problematic scene with Chucky and a speak and spell. And I'm like, fuck off. This is Chucky. Like, of course it's problematic. It's written in to be problematic. It's not, oh, it was the 90s. You were allowed to call women bitches then. It's Chucky will call a woman a bitch in 2019. And when Steve Martin opens his film with I was born a black man,
mm-hmm.
I'm through fucking girlfriend vision going, please don't be blackface.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. But that's fundamentally the heart and soul of the movie too. I think the power, and this is a weird thing.
I think
thing,
you can't say soul we, in yeah, reference to that.
Right. Soul man of the movie. Look, on the other side of Soul Man, all movies are fine.
Right.
Once you've gotten through the film Soul Man, which we did do on our show, and it was the last time two humans have ever watched that movie, as you can tell from polite society still existing today. I was going to make another Virginia joke, but I won't push it. I don't want to trigger anybody, remind anybody of the harsh reality we live in. But that is the whole fucking thing, right? Is so many movies can be brought down by the changing zeitgeist, especially in comedy, where you're pushing buttons. And very rarely are movies made smarter or better by that. And I feel like in this, you know, the era we live in and what sort of terrible things terrible people are doing and saying will unfortunately always have some pull over how a movie feels.
Mm-hmm.
If Steve Martin phrases something in a way that a very public racist does, then suddenly it feels a little worse despite where his heart is at the time or even the point of the joke.
Sure.
But we're in a moment right this second where I feel like most of that is avoided. And so most of what's great about the movie shines through and even comes off maybe as smarter than it did at the time.
This movie
is, if we're lucky, smarter than it did at the time.
It's really interesting because, you know, we definitely come from a place that adores cult movies on Double Feature. But I think it's maybe once every 3 years that we hit a movie like The Jerk or Up in Smoke, where it just feels rich in cultism and every scene just feels like a gag that every movie I've ever seen has seen.
Yeah.
I feel like every comedy I have ever watched is, I mean, literally, but also, you know, from a metaphorical standpoint, is from a world that has seen The Jerk.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's one of those things, we get this in comedies all the time, the same way we kind of went through sort of a semi-exhaustive look at action stars, or I did, and it bled onto the show.
Mm-hmm.
But comedians are the same way, or comedic actors more specifically, because there's comedy films, which, you know, like The Watch.
Yeah.
But then there's films that are driven by the performance of a single individual as a vehicle. I think of the Paul Blart Mall Cop or Deuce Bigelow or, you know, the other, I'm just picking the worst ones I can think
of.
But, you know, Anchorman or The Pest or The Jerk or The Blues Brothers even, right? The Blues Brothers isn't really a plot movie. It's that John Belushi and Interesting Factoid are fucking magnetic. And I think that The Jerk is basically just a film that is built around the sheer fact that the dentist in Little Shop of Horrors is really fucking funny. And we need a whole movie with that guy.
Yeah.
I honestly think that Evil Dead is a really good marriage of these because, you know, it's basically just the Bruce Campbell show and they just arbitrarily piece together a plot that allows Bruce Campbell to be as Bruce Campbell-y as possible.
Yeah.
And The Jerk feels largely that way too because the plot doesn't really matter. And that is why last week I made some stupid, inane joke about who is the true because I think that, you know, blah, 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 Steve Martin is the master.
Yeah.
And L. Ron Hubbard is a jerk. So there you go. There's my...
You did answer the question. I'm so happy. So happy when we set up anything that pays off on this show. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're looking for something new and fresh, sometimes the best thing to do is look at something old like this. Look at something that is classic in a way or is masterful or comes from... You know, we know how many comedians were inspired by Steve Martin, but then when you watch him do something, this is his first feature film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's going out and doing something that feels edgy.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels edgy in a way that if you're trying to be edgy today, you wouldn't even do something quite the same way that this is done. Right. So one of the things that's magic to me about The Jerk is that it manages to feel really fresh and new despite being old, despite being, mm-hmm. have been around and, as you pointed out, having so many things that are derivative because it inspired so many people. It still plays out the way movies just don't today. So if you haven't seen it, you can go back to it. When I'm looking for things that feel new or feel edgy, I'm always trying to find movies that just came out or are only in festivals or haven't even fucking made it to festivals yet. Just what is the freshest fucking idea?
Or Bo Burnham directed. Yeah, right.
And I forget that, well, there are eras of cinema where we have decided movies don't get made this way anymore. They don't exist this way anymore. And if you want to look at edgy, I mean, a comedian getting his own major studio film that is a one-man show of his stand-up fitted into a feature. And by the way, it speaks on race, but from the perspective of this white guy,
mm-hmm.
in a way that feels extremely dangerous. Like, oh no, we hope it doesn't fall on the wrong side, you know?
Right.
And all of that is just... It's not smart enough to make a movie that way today. People would think there's too many risks to that, and they might be right. But what that means is, so you're just not going to get one today, and you got mm-hmm. one back then. And so I do think we can look back to movies from the 70s, 60s, 50s, and, you know, see these films that feel very different because just nothing like this gets made anymore.
Right.
Steve Martin, I think, just as a human, just as an individual, has an entire style about him that while I see, you know, how he inspired people, I don't even think we have comedians like that anymore.
No.
And still being around today and playing shows and had just shown up on SNL a couple months ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, that voice is still out there. And nothing is really existing in parallel to it.
Right.
So this was at a time where I don't remember the years that he blew up, and I don't know a terrible amount about Steve Martin, which is probably why this feels so fucking fresh to me, because I just don't know his body of work terribly well. But, you know, he had gotten some acclaim in stand-up for having a pretty bizarre show, and then wanted to transition into feature films. And so this whole movie came out of that line from his stand-up about, it wasn't always easy for me being a born black child or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole genesis of the project. And then basically it's written scene after scene as, oh, well, here's a little bit in my stand-up. How does that turn into a scene?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great idea if you're Steve Martin, because I think, and I, how familiar are you with his stand-up? Have you seen any of it?
Oh, like, no. I mean, I think I saw part of like a Netflix special.
Yeah.
Like so, a recent one. Yeah.
So you could really, I mean, you wanna go back and watch that yourself, or certainly fucking talk to somebody who's familiar with it. But what struck me seeing early Steve Martin stuff is that he really had this act that was just, it was not what you would assume would make a great movie adaptation. It was not narrative. It was not a storytelling style, right? It's the antithesis of today's comedians that walk you through things, you know, turn anecdotes into epic narratives, come back around to other pieces of previous stories.
Right.
Something like, you know, even something a little different, like you look at the big Nanette stand-up from last year or the year before, whenever that was, you know, it's almost a fucking TED talk, right? It's extremely coherent. And his act was wild because it had no storytelling to it, no segues to it. It almost just looked like a person fucking vamping for an hour, just getting up there and just sort of seeing like, does this make the audience laugh? Nope. Try this thing. Nope. Try this thing. And so there was this sort of irreverency that way. And while you would think at first glance that, okay, well, that doesn't make a movie because there's nothing there. A person with a TED talk has a narrative, you know, that has a narrative thrust to it. It has, you could outline it and go, well, how do you make a movie version of that? Sit there and think about it. If you just look at a bunch of random gags from something Steve Martin's doing, it could kill, but there, you don't walk away going, and this is what that was about. And here was the broader theme. And here was the story that's being told. Except the other thing it does is it's just an idea genesis machine, because what that means is that none of his ideas are over-milked. They're just like punchline after punchline from out of nowhere. And so if you wanted to milk them a little further, you could build out a scene from one of these things. And you do that a couple times, and then you have a collection of scenes. And then you just need a way to drag a wild guy through a bunch of scenes. And now we have what feels like a 70s comedian movie, like a Cheech and Chong movie, like you were saying.
Right.
An excuse to go on the road and do bits.
It's really weird, too, because I think, you know, another movie that this reminds me of that nobody has seen except you and I is Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're just kind of, I think based on, you know, what you're saying about the Steve Martin-ism to the film is you just can't, trying to figure out how the movie is going to end is so much missing the point. And the craft is so much in front of the camera. I think in the next movie, we're going to, you know, the major contrast to what you're saying is it's basically just sort of like a random string of ideas that turns into a coherent film, and the magic is all taking place because it's pointed at Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And the next movie we're going to cover is that other director who's not Quentin Tarantino. And it's,
you mean
it's
the famous
the opposite
guy.
Thing. Right.
The Christopher Nolan movie, The Master. Yeah.
Right. It's a whole other thing. I mean, like you watch a Paul Thomas Anderson movie and you go, oh my God, this guy must have sat in a dark room with a pencil and a pad for 8 years coming up with what's going on here. And you watch The Jerk and you're like, I'm not sure they knew how this scene was going to end when they started filming that day.
It flies by the seat of its pants. And that felt very Steve Martin to me. But also I think, you know, and that wasn't, Steve Martin wasn't somebody who just got out there and had no idea what he was going to do. I mean, he incorporated music and he built on things, and he was a, I'm using past tense because I think about the genesis of his stand-up, but he was somebody who always did and probably continues to think very strategically in where he's moving or how he does something. You know, he wanted to be a comedian and he wanted to get mixed up in it immediately. And so much of his act was also, I don't even really want to say experimental so much as it's like a live focus group or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of, here's some things I have. I wonder if these will work. And I really think you can see him trying things out and then maybe being pleasantly surprised just to see, okay, this thing, like this bit's killing, expand on this, do more here. And so that's to me what gives it that feeling that stays fresh, that feeling that stays, you know, watching it minute to minute feels like we didn't even know how the scene was going to end. Is mm-hmm. because it can just move and go to these places and get a genuine surprise out of him when it does. I think when you go back and watch it, though, because like I was saying earlier, comedy stays at the forefront of pushing issues. One of the things that gives me that horrified feeling, that kind of alarm, oh no, what is this movie going to do? Is the feeling that it's fresh, but also the kind of, it doesn't have, you talk a lot about dog whistles. That's it's a phrase you like.
Mm-hmm.
I think we look in modern society, especially at dog whistles, and we usually use those words to describe when people are being racist, but don't want to be surface racist. So they use dog whistles.
Sure.
But I think or virtue signaling, people talk mm-hmm. about that as usually in a more progressive way. But there is a coded language that we use so that when we speak an idea, people know if we're being racist or not, or if we're trying to say something challenging but progressive,
mm-hmm.
just to give people a sort of flavor of what camp we're in. And as time mm-hmm. goes on, I think there's more and more of that that appears in speech. But part of that, you see that really on Twitter. I mean, that's a big place where people almost have Twitter accents depending on, you know, how they're going to talk and if they're wearing a red hat or not.
Mm-hmm.
And because comedy stays so in the moment and is so about, look, I'm going to say this big idea or even dangerous idea and see how a room reacts. And so much of it is about cutting into things that audiences aren't speaking aloud or things we might all be thinking, but no one's saying yet, or, you know, the sort of idea that doesn't have a word for it or a phrase for it, or you're not supposed to say whether that idea itself is inherently bad or good because mm-hmm. of that. No language has been developed for it yet. So when you see edgy comedy, regardless of the issue and if it's, you know, socially progressive or not, or even, you know, good or evil, it often does not come prepackaged in the verbiage that you're used to hearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
In dog whistles. Comedy often does not have dog whistles because it's just too new.
Right.
Those exist after people have just churned and churned through the conversation. And there's a memification where we start noticing, oh, when a person says this, what they secretly mean is I'm a fucking racist.
Sure. You know,
when somebody describes a black person as articulate, right? We call that a dog whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Intentional or not, that's an example of a dog whistle. And it's appeared because so many racists have described black people as articulate that we just all start to know that when somebody does that or says, I have a black friend or whatever, then we sure. start to
or
know.
Or I'm not racist, but.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. We start to go, oh, I've seen this before. I know
yeah.
you have a tell and we've all picked up on it. And comedy is the first one to conversations. So none of that has built up. So if you want to, even if you want a really socially progressive dog whistle, you wouldn't be able to really embed that into something. You know, when you go back and look at The Jerk, you don't get the signals that tell you, oh, Steve Martin's about to talk about race. Is he going to do this in a way that holds up racial equality, or is he going to do it in a racist way? And I think it scares everybody when they watch it. in a modern audience, because you want to know, you're sitting down, somebody's about to spew ideas at you, and if you laugh, you're giving some sort of symbolic agreement, or I'm on your side, right? You're giving some sort of, if you laugh at something somebody's intentionally trying to make you laugh at, you're sort of becoming their ally in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that scares people about older comedy, because they don't know if it's on the right side of history or not. It's not using the language they're used to, or the language that would be developed over time. And they just don't know how it's going to go. That's a little piece of danger to these movies that, for better or worse, I've really started enjoying. The safest way to enjoy that is just to sit back and watch other people watch the movie, and then you don't have to participate in it. But you could just kind of go, oh, I wonder how people are going to interpret this. I don't have a segue, but in the spirit of Steve Martin, fuck segues, and let's talk about The Master.
Yeah, I'm not racist, but The Master is a movie about...
Hey, tell me about all your white friends from The Master. A movie about white people, and it's called The Master. Not doing it any favors here, am I?
It's...
The Master, a movie that's surprisingly not about racism. Go on.
I mean, it's about Scientology.
Oof. Okay, how much of this conversation do you want to fill with Scientology?
Not that much.
Okay, but maybe a little?
Definitely... I mean, well, so here's the thing is going into this movie, let me digress slightly. How much Paul Thomas Anderson have we covered on Double Feature?
We have covered Magnolia.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that is it.
That's what I thought. Okay. So I knew that The Master was a movie about L. Ron Hubbard or something. That's kind of what I knew. And that it featured in a sort of similar to The Jerk in a meta way, Philip Seymour Hoffman at the top of his game, say a masterclass in acting.
Oof. Pain. Just pain.
I know, I'm sorry. Going into Paul Thomas Anderson has always been really scary for me. And here's why. Because I often joke about film school or people who go to film school. And I always say, I always talk about film school as where you major in Tarantino with a minor in PTA. And I always say it that way because I'm unfamiliar with how you would possibly major in PTA and minor in Tarantino, because Tarantino visually and from a directorial standpoint is loud as fuck. And Paul Thomas Anderson somehow turns out movies, and I'm not sure he ever opens his mouth. So watching The Master and watching any Paul Thomas Anderson on the podcast has been really scary for me because, and I'm still going to say it, and I've seen a lot of these, I just don't fucking get it. I don't understand how these movies get made. I can't find the voice, but not in a bad way. I mean, it's almost like he suggests the films into existence.
Yeah.
And then you just watch it and go, has this always been here?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's sort of this transcendent timelessness, much like Steve Martin, where I'm watching this movie going, I feel like this movie could have come out in 1940 or 20 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. I think that The Master is one of the most of its time of the movies for a couple of reasons. One, of course, is Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, but that has nothing to do with Paul Thomas Anderson. It's just that he's not here anymore, and you watch this movie and he's so front and center, maybe in a way that he's not in almost any other movie, really, that I can think of.
I can think of the one, and we've covered it on the show.
Have we?
The Synecdoche, New York. Yeah, that one is...
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, all right. It's just such a big role for him to play, and it's showy in a way, and it's...
Oh, yeah.
You know, as you were describing, it's got these quasi... inspired by, like, we're talking about a thing but not talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to stare at the performance for clues and all of that. But the other thing is that it has a hook that was of the time. And I don't think that's true for really any of the other of his movies that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
The hook being sort of Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came out, nobody had really made a Scientology movie. And what's interesting is in the time that's transpired, I feel like people have stopped talking about The Master as a Scientology movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we still know it's there, but it's comfortable in its own skin. It's not a sort of, oh, well, there's a big story about this, and so we made a quick and fast movie to talk about it. But I was so interested in how it's kind of about Scientology when it came out, because that seemed very unlike Paul Thomas Anderson to do something mm-hmm. like that. So this is the one of his films, really, that I don't ask myself that question you do. I think you said it, you know, how did this get made? Was that the...
Yeah.
Not usually the reason you use that phrase, but yeah, I take your
right,
point.
Sure.
Like, what... Yeah. Again, I just think the hook. What's the hook of this movie? What's
yeah.
the
yeah.
Why did he pitch this movie and people said, sure. obviously now is the time
right.
for that?
Sure. It's like when The Phantom Thread came out and I'm like, is that actually about sewing? And people insisted that it was in fact about sewing.
Right.
And one of the best movies to ever come out that year.
You know, and the answer now is, of course, oh, he's Paul Thomas Anderson. And so people
right.
just go,
Tarantino can do whatever he wants. Yeah.
Totally.
Well, that's why I like to put those two directors next to each other. If only we had a platform to put two things next to each other and then talk about them in respect. We'll figure it out. We'll figure out a way to do this.
Pencil in Phantom Thread and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah. Well, he can dictate that himself, but there was a time with The Master where it seemed like if this is one of the only movies that if he didn't make it, somebody else would have. That's kind of my feeling about that. If he would not have made The Master,
I don't agree.
Somebody
with
would have
that.
Made not the same movie at all,
yeah.
but some sort of here's the story of L. Ron Hubbard movie.
Sure.
It would have been way
right.
more
Battlefield
literal.
Earth. Right.
It would have,
yeah.
yeah. Well, Maybe today that would be Scientology makes Scientology the movie. But a lot of documentaries were getting made. This was before the big HBO one was made. And, you know, people want to talk about that. It's a very easy thing to talk about. It's very exciting. There are hooks in it. And I think somebody would have made a narrative Scientology film that was not nearly as subtle, that was more directly the story of Scientology had he not. But the other reason that I thought it was fascinating is because Magnolia, as we talked about, quite infamously has that big Tom Cruise role. And mm-hmm. so Paul Thomas Anderson was doing some of the most notable Tom Cruise material at the time. And the whole thing about Scientology is just that, or especially then was, that you don't talk about it. You don't talk about Scientology. You don't make public statements about Scientology. Scientology was trying to delete all the comments from the internet and pull all the videos and just shut the whole thing down. And the fight against Scientology was, let's have more conversations about it. So to make a movie that even lightly danced around it by a guy who appeared to be rather friendly with Tom Cruise in a very important public way, I couldn't help but watch it and go, God, I bet they don't talk anymore. I wonder what Tom Cruise thinks about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so seeing it today, I can separate a lot of that stuff. It doesn't seem to be as about Scientology. But I'm also in the heart of fucking Scientology today. You know, Hollywood is, I mean, the way that Christianity exists in the rest of the country, where it's got its own buildings and people wear jewelry of it around their neck, and it's just mm-hmm. talked about as a thing that people do, and it's totally normal.
Right.
That's Scientology here. It had, you would, if you just appeared in Hollywood, if you'd been transported here from the past, if you'd taken a hot tub time machine, is what I'm getting at. Fuck.
Yes.
It's creeping. That's called hot tub time creep, is what that is. But yeah, if you just woke up and found yourself in Hollywood and walked outside, you would think Scientology is the major fucking religion in the country. It's
right.
crazy.
It's kind of like when you're in China and everyone's a Confucius, but everywhere else in the country, you're like, didn't that die in the 1700s?
Well, I mean, I've never been to China, so I don't know about all that, but I take your point.
Well, you know that kid who got like arrowed to death by the Indonesian tribe?
I'm not reading your Reddit.
He was a Confucius, born a Confucius, converted to Christianity, murdered by an untouched tribe. Beautiful story. Totally going to make a PTA movie about it at some point.
Right, right.
Or they already did, and I just, it's just nobody's uncovered it.
So that sort of the, one of the most impressive parts to me about how this is written, and the part that I can't help but study and be interested in as I'm watching it, is the way in which it's about Scientology without being about it. Because once you start being around it, once people are approaching you on the street several times a week to tell you about Scientology, get you interested, they have a huge, I don't know what they call it, office building, church, whatever the fuck it is, mm-hmm. right next to the Egyptian Theater, which is my second home.
Right.
So every fucking time I go there, there's a person standing outside, a couple people trying painfully to look normal.
Yeah.
Just getting passersby.
And trying to get all your thetans. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Trying to do free processing.
Yeah.
Like they show in the movie. So the ways in the movie in which they mimic Scientology and talk about it and really address the core issues of it without calling the church out specifically end up being really interesting to me because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've said my piece on Scientology. The other more important thing you wanted to talk about in this movie.
Yeah. So, well, the other really kind of, the thing that I think is really important about this movie is the other person in this movie is Joaquin Phoenix's character.
Mm.
The sort of, man, ever since we've adopted this term, I just throw it around all over the place because I love it. But the soft-mindedness of a
because it's the only safe way we can do it, right? Because anything else will later look like some weird problematic phrase.
Yeah.
And it's hard to talk about. Yeah, but that's, you know, I made the joke at the top about Forrest Gump. I mean, here we are talking about it.
Yeah.
And you said you don't want to address whether or not the master helps him in this movie.
Right. No, right. I don't.
I'd like to point out once again that that's out there and you won't find it here.
I think what it allows for is this, much like the opening line to The Jerk, I think what his character allows for is this sort of in-depth study on, dive right back into Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, what he's doing and his motivations and what he feels like he can get away with and all of this stuff. Because when you're talking about cultism, to me, it's just like a fucking pyramid scheme of the mind.
Uh-huh.
Where the hardest thing about starting a pyramid scheme is not maintaining. Apparently the easiest thing about starting a pyramid scheme is once you get it started, just raking in tons of cash with absolutely no legal action taken against you because you just called it multi-level marketing.
I'm writing this down. Go on.
What I think the hardest thing is about a pyramid scheme or MLM or anything like that is getting that first fucking person to believe that you are the goddamn best thing since sliced fucking bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what this movie is about to me, is the moment that fucking Jim Jones went from I have a good idea to people will do anything I say. And it's when he encounters somebody soft-minded enough to buy him for a full fucking dollar and sit down and go, okay, you know what? I'm an empty vessel. Fill me with your bullshit.
Yeah, I think that if we really want to have, you know, let's call out, let's just make this as approachable as possible. I want to find the gold in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You're watching the movie, you're sitting there just taking it in, and as it's running and you're watching this, do you have a moment just along the timeline, the runtime of the film, where you sit up and go, oh, this is fascinating. This development or this, you know, is there a point that you have in the movie where you're going, wow, now this is getting really good here, or this is like where we're getting to the meat of it, or something's clicking?
For me, I think the first moment I can really think of, I'm sure there's 100, because this movie hits me all at once, even though it's, you know, 2 hours long. I feel like it's a flash and then you've just seen it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a thing. But for me, it's when he asks if he slept with any member of his family.
Sure, sure.
That's the moment, because he goes, have you slept with any member of your family? And it's not that the answer is yes. It's that all the places that there were hesitation before, there isn't there.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a moment where you see the defensive foot go, wait, what? And yeah, it's almost Philip Seymour Hoffman, his character being like, yeah, I'm dragging you through the mud. I'm going to get to the, wait, incest?
Yeah.
And he's like, basically like, I really want to know more about that, but I'm trying really hard to be King Scientology over here.
Yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, they're certainly competent throughout the film. They're good throughout the film, but they always have these moments for me. And maybe it does come down to the runtime. I don't know. But they always have moments for me where I'm watching them and I'm going, oh, this is a good movie. It's a good movie. And then something happens and it's just a showstopper. Something just goes, oh, whatever happens next is going to be really fucking exciting. And yeah, you're right. They have these, you know, the processing moments where they're mm-hmm. basically setting up tests. So there's anticipation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're going, you know, what I'd like to do is sit with you in a room and do something to see what comes out. It might be a little abrasive. Are you sure you want to do it? If you think you're up for it, we'll do it. And the other character goes, yeah, let's really get our hands dirty. Let's dig in and fucking figure something out. And I feel like, oh, I'm about to be rewarded. Something fascinating is going to happen.
Yeah.
The moment that always does it for me in The Master, every fucking time, is where he's sitting on the couch and he's got a couple people going on and he's yammering on Seymour Hoffman's character, who's just
I think I know which scene you're talking about. Yep.
Total fucking grifter, which is also something I've become really well acquainted with in my time
Intimately acquainted with.
Yeah, seriously. But that's, you know, you're approached by as many grifters in Hollywood as you are Scientologists, so that happens.
Trying to get your thetans and your money.
Yeah, but I've been thinking about that word a lot lately. But he's sitting on the couch and he's saying a bunch of nothing, which I also like, the way his dialogue's written.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite things about the character. Yeah.
The kind of person.
He's basically a walking pep rally for himself.
Yeah. And you see these people, and MLM people are really, hit it with that, because they can just go on and they speak the way a wall of sound score does in a movie, where you feel things, but you don't even really know why or what the fuck is going on. It's just
right.
Hitting you, your animal brain. So he's sitting on the couch. He's got his flock around him. And then there's this annoying guy off to the side. The excuse me guy. Excuse me. Excuse me. Just at these jarring moments. And he's ignored almost to the point, and I love the way it's done. You know, I love the filmmaking technique to this, where no one really acknowledges him. You could have a bunch of reaction shots.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this guy's starting to cause some turmoil. Some, you know, people are looking around. Who's this guy? But instead, the film doesn't acknowledge him. So I always sit there going, even knowing the scene's coming, going, who around here is shouting excuse me at me while I'm trying to watch this movie?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the fuck is going on here? And finally, his character turns to address this guy. And now it's already been so built up, because you're just going, what the fuck does this guy want? And it is the first real moment, I feel, in the film where there is a challenge of skepticism to this character who's just been presented as the end-all be-all to everything. He is these people's messiah. He is their fucking god. And he's a nuclear physicist and a poet and a raconteur and whatever other ridiculous, you know, MD, PhD, MOC, whatever he is.
Mm-hmm, right.
And nobody challenges him. And the audience can't even really think to be skeptical of him, even though they should, because he's just got such a good rapport and he's funny and he's a storyteller and he's charming. And this is the first guy who stands up and goes, hey, but all the stuff you're saying, yeah, but like, it's nonsense, right? And it breaks the spell for me that I've been going along through this movie just thinking, oh, I know the movie I'm watching. I know the course I'm on. It doesn't turn the plot. It's not a twist in the movie. And it's something that really I should know as an audience member. It's there. But it breaks the spell. And it makes me kind of sit up and go, I didn't realize it, but Mr. Perfect over here has never been challenged.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to get challenged by our protagonist, by the people around him. We've just been going along in a Totoro movie with no obstacles, where we're just enjoying floating around in the forest with this fascinating, spellbinding man. And it's abrasive. And then to watch, oh, I don't know how this guy would react in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there continue to be these moments throughout the story where other people kind of wake up to him, or you find out secretly how skeptical some of the people around him are until, you know, the law is intervening for him running, you know, a medical clinic or whatever the fuck they call it, you know, out of his house. And those are the moments that I always walk away from the film feeling like there was some kind of, that those were the next level moments of the film.
So just to recap, the next level moment of the master for you is anytime anybody had the wherewithal to question a cult leader, and the next level moment of the jerk was, I was born a young black man.
Yeah, well, because I never get comfortable again in the jerk.
Exactly.
That's why. Because I sit up, that's the moment I sit up in the jerk, and I never regain comfort. I'm just anxious the whole time. We have a website, patreon.com/doublefeature, where you can contribute to us doing the challenging mindfuck movies throughout time, and also finally getting to things like The Master.
And Back in Time. Don't forget Back in Time.
All of you probably think we should have done a million years ago. Yeah, and Back in Time too. I want to thank Ben Ecker, Brett Hayton, Bruno, Charles, John, Mark, Tom, and Abbott of Unreason. Unfortunately, there's no time, so I can't tell you what's going on with that, as I promised.
No time.
Fine. What? What do you want? What?
I think it's about time.
You've been shouting excuse me at me for 3 episodes. Mm. What? What is it? You got a human centipede you want to do or something? What's going on?
Next time on Double Feature.
Yeah.
We're going to cover a pair of movies. We're going to do Toad Road and Toad Road and what is it? It's not I Saw the Devil. It's
maybe we'll go over
Here Comes
all of
the
these.
Devil. Here Comes the
we'll
Devil.
We'll go over
Here Comes the
various comings and goings of the devil next time on the show. I don't know what these movies have to do with time. I feel like, is it about the end of the year? It's not even the end of the year yet. I don't understand why you're doing this to me.
Yeah. So next time on Double Feature, we're going to do Toad Road and Here Comes the Devil. And that's not a joke. Those are the movies we're actually doing.
You know, all this time, I feel like you're committing some kind of time crime over here. Okay, well, anyways, I guess we're going to do those films. This is only funny to me and you. Maybe we'll become funny to somebody else some other day on the show, but that day is not the next day.
The thing that's funny is that these jokes are literally too soon. And
literal too soon.
When they come back around, it's like the show that we're referencing went back in time and ruined the 3 previous shows.
Fucking stop. 4 previous.
Watch
5.
More fucking film.
All right. Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.